There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer. Not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains descriptions of violence, including violence against women and children. It also contains discussions of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, Lizzie. How are you?
Good, Joe. How are you?
I am well. Welcome to this episode, which I think you're leading.
I am. This is a topic that I'm looking forward to discussing.
Well, it's certainly a topic that's been a lot in the media. And in that sense, I think, a lot of people are talking about it a lot.
Yes, with good reason. I've called this one generally an episode about violence against women,
yep,
but I could easily have called it male killers or killers of women and children,
okay,
because that's the focus of what we're going to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
And look, it was sparked, I guess, by the recent murder of Lily James. So not all of our listeners might be familiar with that case. So I'll give a little bit of background.
Yep.
On October 25 this year, Lily James, she was 21 at the time. She was the victim of a brutal murder.
Mm.
She was found dead in the gym bathroom of the school that she was a water polo coach at, St. Andrew's Cathedral School in Sydney. And she was found shortly after midnight. Her killer had called the police to alert them to the murder. And officers described the scene of that murder as confronting, to say the least. It's been described as horrific, horrendous, brutal, all of those things. And Lily's killer then committed suicide.
So he calls the police, reports the body in the toilets, and then is later found dead.
Yes, he had jumped off the cliffs.
The gap, in Sydney.
Yeah. He'd also sent a text message to Lily's dad, I'm pretty sure, before he killed himself as well. So word got out quite quickly that Lily had been killed, and she was found quite quickly. In fact, she was found, and then there was a hunt for the killer, and it was only a day or so later that his body was found.
Mm. Do you know what the text message to the father said?
Something about going to the school, or that she was at the school,
right?
I think.
Okay.
Yeah, because Lily and her killer, and his name is Paul Fison. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but they had dated very briefly. He also worked at St. Andrews for a matter of weeks. They dated, and then she had broken up with him, or they had not continued to see each other. He had knowledge of her family to an extent, and they worked together. So,
and how old was he?
He was, that is a good question. He was 25, I think. What do I want to say about this? Let me give you some more background. So her murder, which I would say was a completely senseless murder, sparked a massive reaction in the press and in the community. So just for an example, I did a Google search of her name and 27,000 results came up.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
As a result of her murder, domestic violence against women has, again, been the focus of the media, although I feel like it's raised every week because there are women killed every week. And so what I wanted to talk about is an aspect of what has unfolded because of Lily James's murder, which is what's known colloquially as the good bloke narrative. There's this seeming persistence of the media and people generally to, on occasion, try and minimize the actions of murderers when they don't fit the, you know, perceived image or the preferred image of who is an abuser or who is a killer.
All right. Well, I mean, I've got a pretty good idea of what the good bloke narrative is, but can you just step it out for me?
Yes. So it's a societal perception, and I think it can be very detrimental, but when discussing violence against women, it refers to the idea that some men who might otherwise be considered decent, kind, or good blokes in many aspects of their lives can still perpetrate or exercise violence against women, but it's an aberration for them that they were an otherwise good bloke, that in other respects they were a role model, they were, you know, so kind, they were charismatic, whatever it might be.
Sure.
And so it has contributed, I think, to a really complex set of issues surrounding attitudes, behaviours and norms when it comes to discussions of killers like Paul Fison, like Rowan Baxter, who I'll talk about soon, but killed Hannah Clark and his three children.
Well, sorry, can I just jump in? So You said before this good bloke narrative doesn't, you know, is problematic because, you know, it's used when people don't fit the usual, what people usually think an abuser is like. What do people usually think an abuser is like?
Well, I mean, I don't know that anyone could necessarily describe an abuser, but I think what we see is this idea that it doesn't happen to me. So let me give you a statistic.
Yeah, so you said before a woman dying every week, and I was going to jump in and say, what, did you have some statistics? So you do.
Yeah, I do. So Lily was the 53rd woman to be killed via violence this year in Australia. There is a group who are called Counting Dead Women Australia. They're researchers.
Yes. Sorry, I'm assuming that's 53rd woman, intimate partner homicide, well, not died in car crashes or...
Because of violence.
Presumably it's intimate partner violence.
I think the majority of them are, but this group, Destroy the Joint, are tracking all violent deaths against women. So, yes, the majority of them are intimate partner violence or domestic violence related.
Yes.
But I couldn't say with certainty that all 53 were.
No.
But the majority are. At least 3,600 women are admitted to hospital in a year because of an assault. We had research that shows 5,000 calls related to domestic or family violence are made to the police each week. One in six women have experienced physical and or sexual violence perpetrated by a man since the age of 15. And one in four women have experienced emotional abuse by a current or previous partner since the age of 15. These are the facts. These are the statistics. And so I would say that all of us would be able to say at least one person they know of who has been subject to abuse by a partner. We know that. We know someone who's been sexually assaulted, physically assaulted, or the victim of domestic violence. But how many people admit to knowing the offenders? Because there are a lot of offenders out there if we look at these statistics, but no one's saying, oh, yeah, that was my brother, or that was my partner, or that's a friend I know.
Okay, but where does that take you? So Paul Thyssen's family stick up their hand and go, yeah, that was our son, brother.
Let me tell you. Yeah. So there was a survey done, the latest National Community Attitude Survey on Violence Against Women, and it was conducted by Australia's National Research Organisation for Women's Safety, which is known colloquially as ANROS.
Mm-hmm.
And this was released in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So 91% of Australians believe that domestic and family violence is a major problem.
Okay.
Great, it is. But only 47%, so less than half of those surveyed, believe it to be a problem in their town or their community or their suburb.
Mm-hmm.
So people realise it's a problem, but they think it's a problem happening somewhere else to someone else. And this idea that we can't acknowledge, or people don't want to acknowledge, that your neighbour, your friend, the guy who's just been identified as a killer is a monster or is...
I really take issue with that word, is a monster.
No, but that's the problem. People don't want to acknowledge that. Like they try and it's... So this was triggered for me by the open letter, or the letter that was released by the ex-principal of St Andrews,
yep,
who had known Paul Thyssen when he was a student there.
Yes.
And in his letter, he was expressing condolences for Lily's family, which was, you know, a lot of the appropriate content was in that letter. But he also said in his letter, he described Thyssen as a fine student, a prefect and a role model, and he specifically said he was not a monster, rather he committed a monstrous act. And that is a really damaging perspective to take, because we're talking about Paul Thyssen because he made a calculated decision to murder Lily and then take his own life. So what does it matter if he was a role model in school? What does it matter if he was a prefect? None of that should be relevant to a discussion of him as a killer. Like, it sets up this idea that, oh, it was a brain snap, or he snapped, or he would never normally have done this. Who cares what he would normally have done? Well, he did it.
Well, okay, let me just jump in.
Yes,
you having been a prosecutor, you are aware that that's a common submission to make in a sentencing hearing. So
not by prosecution.
No, obviously not by prosecution, but you've heard it. I'm defence counsel, so I've made that submission 100 times more. You know, that whatever the behaviour that they're being punished for is out of character. And that is something that the court takes into account, that this person is not somebody who is, as a general rule, you know, doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, previous good character is something the courts take into account. I presume you agree they should take it into account. If you've got no criminal history and you commit an offence, obviously it should be taken into account.
What if you're a sex offender and the reason you have no criminal history is because of the very secretive nature of your conduct? And so being, you know, a community leader or someone who's done good in other parts of your life, why should that count for anything if you've been abusing children in secret?
Okay, we're getting a bit off topic here. The court has to act on the information before it. If the prosecution want to put that information in that, you know, the person, although having never been charged, isn't of good character, I'm sure they would. But you accept it's a common
submission.
And appropriate, it's in the legislation, that the court should take into account that a person is of previous good character.
Yes.
Okay, so...
But why...
I mean, I think just as a matter of law, that's appropriate. And I think people in the community generally understand that. Now, this principle, I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to just take a couple of stabs in the dark about, you know, educated guesses, let's say. So he writes a condolence letter, open letter. Now, he has to say what he doesn't have to. He chooses to say something about Paul Thyssen. He can only honestly write about his own interactions with Paul Thyssen. Now, if he doesn't say anything about the guy who he was the principal of and presumably taught and interacted with when he was a prefect, I mean, that's a bit odd in itself.
Why? Why should it matter? Like, honestly, if someone has chosen to kill in this horrific, brutal manner, has enough presence of mind to dispose of the weapon, to make texts and phone calls, and then take his own life, why does it matter if he did anything good before? Like,
well, I mean, it depends what exactly. I think it is absolutely relevant, and I'll explain why. Because as soon as you paint him like a monster, you say, "Oh, the statistics show nobody really, or less than 50% of people believe it's happening in their community." Because my point is exactly this: the people who often commit these kind of offences, they're not monsters. These events are aberrations, and so to understand that really this is a problem that could happen in your neighbourhood, in your street, people you know who you wouldn't expect, that's, I think, the real issue. The idea that, you know, oh, well, you know, they're monsters and, you know, you'd pick them. That's why people go, oh, they're not in my community.
No, I don't want them to be called monsters. I want an acknowledgement that killers and abusers are just ordinary men.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But my point is, I think the way that you're saying, well, why say anything good about him? You've got to paint him as an ordinary person. You've got to explain both the good and the bad of his life so that society can understand that people like that, ordinary people, can commit these kind of offences.
But you can achieve the same thing by saying Paul Thyssen had no criminal history, he had no previous offending, but he made this decision. He was an ordinary person. You don't have to go and give him any kind of adulation for being a school prefect or being a role model or turning up every day to his job and doing a good job. That isn't actually relevant. What's relevant is these are people who live and work next to you. They are ordinary people. And they are killers.
Well, look, I don't know what the headmaster's point was, but I mean, in the sense that he was giving a description of the Paul Thyssen he knew, I mean, I don't think that it's out of, you know, to say the guy was a prefect. But I mean, I think in some senses that helped. They're ordinary people, but they may well be high achieving people. He sounds like, for a 25-year-old, you know, he was doing reasonably well on the scale of success. He had obviously was somebody who had the respect of his peers at school, or the teachers. I don't know how they chose prefects or whatever school he went to, but, you know, he was a prefect. But I mean, I think that's important to understand.
Well, maybe if he was being sentenced, in a court for the crime that he'd committed, a judge could have a look at that. But when we put it out there in the media, it's sort of like saying, oh, I know he committed this horrendous murder, but he was actually a really good guy. He's not.
Well,
and that's the bottom line.
When you say, okay, he's not a good guy, he obviously committed just an absolutely horrendous murder, absolutely. And that's an aspect of his personality. But I think to say that's the totality of his personality is not, I don't think that helps the debate at all. I think that to understand, you know, as Hannah Arendt put it, the banality of evil. I do want to unpack the whole banality of evil thing, because I think it's important. And what I object to about the people saying, oh, the good bloke effect, it's terrible, I think they're falling into exactly the trap that Hannah Arendt identified when she published her book, The Banality of Evil, back in the 50s. You know, she watches the trial of Adolf Eichmann, the ultimate, you know, Nazi bureaucrat, who was the bureaucrat who organized the Final Solution and the death camps and the killings of the Jews and the Polish and the Ronin. You know, but he was just a bureaucrat. He was just a pencil pusher. He was a stamp licker. And she sits in the trial looking at him there, and she is struck by the fact of how ordinary he is. And that realization is what she then writes about. Evil is not something. These people aren't monsters. They are ordinary people who commit terrible acts.
And I absolutely agree with that. But let me just tell you where we go wrong.
Yep.
Okay. So these are some other headlines. Mm. And I should note at this point that all of these killers then committed suicide. Mm. So none of these people have come to court or been charged because they're dead as well.
Yes.
But this is how things are reported. So in 2020, when Rowan Baxter set his three children and his ex-wife on fire in their car and they all died a horrific death and he then stabbed himself.
Yeah.
There was a headline that said, ex-NRL star Rowan Baxter dies alongside three kids in Brisbane car fire tragedy. There was never a second's doubt as to whether he was the perpetrator. There were witnesses who saw the entire thing. It was undeniable that he had set them on fire and then killed himself.
So what narrative do you think that is perpetrating?
It is not putting the responsibility on this man.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they later, that was a maybe not the most highbrow piece of journal. Well, no, sorry, I take that back. But it was Fox Sports Australia. That was the headline. And they later changed their headline to Wife Dies Hours After Her Children Were Killed in Car Inferno Lit by League Player Father. At the same time, the Daily Mail ran this headline, Ex-footy star who died in burning car showered kids with love. Okay. So even a headline that is placing the blame there still has to put in their league player. Disgusting reporting. Disgusting. Then other examples. So in 2014, there was a headline that said, strains that grew inside Jeff Hunt ended in 5 deaths on a farm.
All right, what did Jeff Hunt do?
So he killed his wife and their 3 children before he committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
He shot his 3 children in their beds.
Mm.
He shot his wife in the driveway of their house. He then drove himself to a dam, shot himself and died. He was described as a quiet grain farmer who had suffered considerable pressure and tension, and police believe that he had snapped. Now, that may very well be the case, but again, that is somehow trying to provide some kind of excuse for his decision to take 4 lives before killing himself.
I think it's trying to provide an explanation, not an excuse. I mean, if they just write, shot his 3 kids in their beds and his wife in the driveway, full, you know, and a grain farmer, full stop, the reader's just left with what is going on? You know, is there something in the water? You know, I think they had, you know, explained he's under a lot of pressure. They say he snapped.
Joe, being under pressure.
I didn't say it was a justification. I said it's an explanation.
But the explanation is he couldn't cope himself and he chose to kill his entire family. Like, it doesn't matter if he was an otherwise good guy, because that decision, that choice, that conduct rules out what's come before. You cannot try and say, oh, but apart from killing his entire family, he was a good guy.
Well, apparently he was, you know, well, I don't know. You didn't give me any, you know, context on that one, but you know, I think that is absolutely relevant to know, you know, what it is about these people's lives that is, you know.
What about this one? Peter Miles' heartache blamed for unspeakable violence. That was the ABC in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Miles shot his wife, his adult daughter, and his 4 grandchildren who were aged 13, 12, 10, and 8, and then he killed himself.
Mm.
They'd suffered the loss of a son, I'm pretty sure, and he had not recovered from that.
Mm.
And he decided he couldn't go on and took his entire extended family with him. There's the suggestion there that his heartache, we can understand why he would do it. No, we've got to stop trying to find an explanation.
Wrong. I think we absolutely need to find an explanation. You're not going to be able to solve things unless you find some kind of level of explanation about it.
But how could we have solved that? If this guy just, like, what?
I don't know, because I don't know all the facts of the case. But I think the point is, isn't it, that these things are really hard to predict. They're hard to solve because these people do snap. They do things that are otherwise abnormal, and there is nothing in their previous life that would indicate that that's what's going to happen. It seems to me you're expecting everyone to be like Jeffrey Dahmer, who, you know, grows up having this history of torturing, you know, animals and, you know, pulling the wings off flies or something. And so everyone goes, oh, yeah, no surprises he end up killing people and being a cannibal. I mean, it wasn't easy to see Jeffrey Dahmer, as it turns out, because he managed to kill multiple people. But, you know, I mean, if people are violent and committing a lot of offences, they get picked up in the system. I was, you know, when I'd seen your show notes for this, I was thinking about the kind of people I've represented for very violent crimes, including murderers. And I thought, you know, what kind of people are they? And as a general proposition, you know, they strike you as ordinary people. If you didn't know that they had been convicted of murder, they strike you as utterly ordinary people. There's only, I reckon, 2 occasions in 20 years defending people where I have had violent people who've committed violent crimes who were, when you sit down and deal with them, you realize that they're not right in the head. But they had, a violent history as long as their arm, dating back to when they were kids. You know, so those kind of people are easy to pick. But they are, in my experience, the rarity. Most people who commit violent crimes, you know, it is what's called situational violence, particularly intimate partner violence, situational violence. So the violence occurs within a particular situation. And outside of that situation, the people aren't violent.
But my question is, what is it saying about the value of the victims to say, yeah, look, took their life, brutal murder, killed his grandchildren, but, you know, he was a good bloke. Like.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It minimizes the choices and the conduct of these people to say, oh, well, let's look at why he did it. And, you know, apart from this, he was a good bloke.
Well, I don't think it does. I mean, if it was just like, oh, this guy's a total monster, wouldn't people be saying, well, why did Lily James date him in the first place? He was a complete monster. Why was she dating him? I mean, the fact that he was, you know, a solid guy.
I don't
guy,
want them to be characterised as monsters. I want people to understand they're ordinary people, but ordinary is different to a good bloke. Ordinary means any person could commit these crimes, and ordinary people do commit these crimes. But I can't understand the need to try and say, oh, but apart from this, look at all of the good they did, because every person does good in their life. There's always something you can point to that has been good, but that actually isn't relevant when discussing crimes like this, because...
Sorry, well, when you say it's not relevant, these people are dead. They are never put on trial. So there's never any sentencing hearing where the kinds of issues we're discussing would be judged in a legal sense. In some senses, they're being judged in the court of public opinion. And in that sense, I would say, well, having some their side of the story put, if it's a sentence in the court of public opinion, is very sensible. But where else do we go with it? The only other place we could go is working out how we can reduce this kind of violence against women occurring. And to do that, you need a proper understanding, which is an understanding, I think, of these people. And, you know, if they are people who are otherwise upstanding members of the community, that is a very, very relevant factor. You know, if we're just looking at Jeffrey Dahmer, who's, you know, torturing animals, they're easy to find. People who are upstanding members of the community, not so easy to find.
I think for me, I see a link between this good bloke narrative that I refer to and the idea of, and I'm scared to say this to
go
you.
Go on, fire away.
Toxic masculinity.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I was wondering when that was going to come coming. Up. Yes, okay, fire
so,
away.
So toxic masculinity, to be clear, refers to harmful expectations or behaviours that society attributes to men and includes beliefs that men should always appear strong, suppress emotions, dominate others, and avoid anything considered feminine. This harmful notion, which is a, you know, researched idea, can lead to aggression, suppression of feelings, and the reinforcement of negative stereotypes about masculinity. So in the aftermath of Lily's death, discussions about the impact specifically of private boys' schools on the culture of toxic masculinity was raised again in the spotlight to see if this idea of toxic masculinity is playing into the creation of good blokes who then go on to kill. you know, like...
Well, sorry, when you say, I mean, nobody's creating good blokes who then go into kilt. They are good blokes who happen to, in a particular, under a particular set of circumstances...
But this perception, that how they're raised, how they develop in terms of attitudes and beliefs and entitlement, I think, well, is it all connected? Does it all flow through? And is it why we now have killers who are described by people as role models or, you know, good people who have snapped, you know?
So is that directed specifically at all boys private schools?
Well, not all boys private schools, no.
Sorry, I mean private school boys, not every private school. Well, I wasn't exactly following where all that was going. So I'll announce my bias straight up. I went to an all boys private school, mm-hmm. and I had a great time. Was there bullying at school? Absolutely. Was there, you know, some of those characteristics that you described amounting to toxic masculinity at the school? Absolutely. I think if you get any group of blokes, boys, males together, that you are going to get some of that, but you're not going to get it from all of them. And
no.
Is it going to become a sort of the dominant sort of culture within the school? Well, I mean, statistically, I suppose it's possible. My experience is no.
Okay. And I think that there is huge variations when it comes to all-boys schools. And I also went to a single-sex school. I was at an all-girls school and I loved it. And mm-hmm. I believed wholeheartedly in the value of single-sex education.
Mm.
I didn't really have that option for my kids, so I now also see the value in co-educational education. If we come back to the types of schools where there is this culture of privilege and entitlement, and look, not related at all to killing, but it made me think of a couple of years ago, 2020, there was a lot of media attention on a leaked year 12 scavenger hunt list
mm-hmm.
from another very elite school, the Shaw School in
mm-hmm.
Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was their muck up week.
Yep.
So let me just put in context for my kids' muck up week in year 12. They had to wear a pink shirt one day. They had a water fight another day.
So the students, because I didn't have a muck-up week. I don't know.
No, so muck-up week. Yeah, but so let me tell you what types of challenges were on this private.
So this is for the graduating students in the final weeks of school. They do things which are sort of against the rules and I presume borderline illegal or actually illegal.
Well, against the rules for the normal course of things, you know, like wearing the wrong uniform.
Yeah.
But this one was extreme. So there were a number of challenges that increased in difficulty, shock level depravity.
Mm.
So it started with things like spitting on a homeless person, performing what they call a sack whack on a random person, which is just hitting someone in the testicles.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty common at all boys' schools in my experience.
I don't want to know about that. Deck a stranger, so punch a stranger. And then it progressed to things involving women. So kiss a girl under the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
Kissing's fine, but let's just remember these are seniors. Kissing?
Yeah, it's an indecent assault.
Well, if it's without consent.
Okay. No,
it's you can consent between the age of 12.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
They're saying kiss someone underage, and these are 17, 18-year-olds.
Yep.
Kiss an Asian chick
okay.
was one of the challenges. Mm-hmm. Have sex with a woman who weighs over 80 kilos
mm-hmm.
or is aged over 40
mm-hmm.
or is deemed a 3 out of 10 or lower.
Mm-hmm.
Someone leaked that scavenger hunt
and
there was a massive furor. I don't know if you remember it.
Mm.
Now, ironically, the principal of that school at that time was dismissed in the wake of this
really?
Scavenger hunt
wow. okay.
scandal. And John Collier, who wrote the letter mm-hmm. in that referred to Paul Thyssen, he was brought in to be principal mm-hmm. of the Shaw School because the governing council stated that new leadership was needed to change the culture of the school. Mm. I don't know, maybe a woman would have been a better choice. Not one single year 12 boy at that time was expelled or
let me say firstly, obviously that list is appalling and a lot of things on it are illegal. I mean, without more information, you can't say it's terrible that no year 12 boy was expelled or disciplined. I mean, you don't, for example, they mightn't have ever found who the author was. And
okay, well, so after the discovery of that scavenger hunt, there were threats to expel any student who participated.
Mm-hmm.
That then headmaster said his school unequivocally condemns the activities detailed in the proposed scavenger hunt,
mm-hmm.
but actually no action at all was taken in relation to the creation of the list itself. And that principal...
So what do you mean? You mean they didn't investigate to try and find out who wrote it?
No.
Okay. It's a bit odd, I think, but all
and
right.
The principal went on to say, the document appears to be the work of a small number of boys who are not representative of our wider Year 12 group.
Okay. Well, so there you go.
Deniability was just these rogue students.
Well, sorry, what if that's the actual... What if that's the case? You know, that it's really just a bunch of... It's just a couple of bad apples.
Well, it wasn't a...
How do you know? I mean, the principal, who presumably knows more than we do.
Because it was shared on there was a private Instagram page. The participants were instructed to keep it a secret. They were meant to post evidence of their completed dares on that private Instagram page. Above all else, on the scavenger list, it said, remember the boys' code. We protect each other at all costs. And so this culture of a school where maybe a small group, but still a group, come up with a list that is so disgusting and nothing comes of it from the school. Like, why there wasn't a proper investigation, why they weren't, it's not that hard to track down people. Like,
Well, I must say, I think it probably is. What do you do? Get all the year 12s together and say, who wrote this? And they all sit there and no one says anything.
But now, so why are they all sitting there? Why are they not?
Well, this could be 100 reasons why, but you know,
they're protecting, because they don't want to be a snitch. They don't want to
It is a common saying in this country that snitches get stitches. I don't even think that's an Australian saying. I think that's just a general saying. You know, so the idea that you wouldn't dob on somebody else, as we would say here in Australia, that's a common, you know,
but
commonly
that doesn't
held
make
belief.
It right.
No, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying it's commonly.
So
you know, you can't just
point.
Say this is
this
something
is
at Shaw
point.
College.
I would like to think I have raised boys who would speak up.
Put their hand up and say, it was little Johnny over there, he did it.
The list was disgusting.
Yes, I completely accept
if
that.
If these
completely
boys
accept that.
Went and did these things, we are talking multitudes of people who would be impacted by their conduct, and they're happily treating it as some kind of big joke.
So who's they? You
the
mean
boys.
The small group of boys who came up with it? We don't know
the
who
the principal said a small group of boys. We don't know how big the group is.
No.
Presumably, but there was
the principal
there
knows
was
better
a
than
lot
we do.
Of challenges well, it, on there.
Yeah, so there's a private institute. So you know, let's say you're a student at Shaw College, you go onto this institute, you know, join this WhatsApp group, and you go, yeah, sure. And then somebody posts something on the group. I mean, that's got nothing necessarily to do with you. You're on the group. You see it. And your point seems to be, well, somebody reported it.
Okay,
it.
Okay, but
and then
but
you say that they
attitude
should've...
is wrong. I can remember there was an incident at my school, my kid's school, and this was some years ago now. But there was an Instagram page that a whole lot of they were only year sevens, a whole lot of year seven boys joined, and they would post photos and make demeaning or belittling or bullying comments on there. And I can tell you that every boy, whether or not they had ever liked or commented on any of those, were punished for being part of that page.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as a lawyer that, you know, passive presence is not...
But you just said you might be on the page and there's...
Yeah, but you said they liked
it.
No,
they did not have
passive.
To like...
They were just
comment.
On the page.
They were just part of the page.
Well, I think that sounds like collective punishment to me, which I'm absolutely against. But anybody who's on the page gets punished because of something one person did. You know, I mean, I think that's it. I mean, if you like it, that's fine. That's different. You've actually actively participated.
No, because I know one boy who did suffer a consequence and he had not touched a button to interact with that page.
Sure.
And someone else had added him.
Well, okay. Well, I mean,
but
I think
didn't
that's...
he didn't remove himself. So... But Joe,
well, sorry, again, it's about what if someone says we're going to put together an Instagram page where we're, you know, racist and sexist and fat shame people, you know, and you know that, and somebody adds you and you don't remove yourself, okay, sure. But
that
if it's
was
just
the point.
Okay, well, you know,
that was the point. I would expect all of my children,
yeah,
to remove themselves.
Yep. No, I agree. If they know in advance what it's about,
or if they're part of it and they see it, It's like that. If you see something, say something. Like, don't be a passive person saying, well, I didn't do anything. No. I wasn't part of it.
Okay.
So coming back to toxic masculinity and violence against women, yes. Experts have stated literally for years that there is a link between elite institutional cultures, male entitlement, and violence against women that cannot be ignored. Power and privilege play a huge part in forming attitudes towards girls and women and framing men who mistreat and, more relevantly, kill women as good blokes who just snapped is actually dangerous. It implies that they aren't really bad men. They just acted out of character when they chose to end the life or lives of their loved ones. It suggests they're not like other murderers or other offenders. And I think that that is where we need to change. So,
but sorry, who are these other murderers or other offenders? I mean, most of the murders, again, I haven't made a study, but I think most of the murders that occur in this country are intimate partner homicides.
Well, that's because we are suffering an absolute crisis with domestic violence. But if you think of, you know, a murderer, right? You might think of
I know a few, actually, and I've represented them, yes.
You know, or you, from reading books, from watching TV, whatever it might be, whatever your perception is, you might think of someone who's scary looking or aggressive or a loner or a drug addict. You know, these ideas are often associated with criminals, with offenders, with people who are violent. And there are definitely people who fall within those categories who do commit crimes, who do kill, you know, or bikies or whatever it is you might think. You know, you hear about a shooting and it's gang related, you've got a vision in your head of who that is. When you think of a murderer being your brother, son, best friend, husband, it doesn't compute. You think, oh, that's...
I mean, I think that to paint the popular culture view of murderers that they are sort of these people with scars on their faces who are always violent and, you know, murder strangers or something, I think that's dangerous because the statistics are you're most likely to be killed by somebody you know. So understanding that, and I mean, I know lots of other murders where the murder, not intimate partner homicide, but the people are known to each other. They're at a party, there's a fight, someone stabs someone in a fight and they die. And these, I mean, not always, but sometimes they're people who are, you know, unblemished character. They don't have a history of violence. One of the problems that they used to have with murderers is that so often they had no previous history of violence. And I'm talking about New South Wales in the, you know, 50s and 60s, is that they had a system where they would classify you into jail depending on your criminal history. And because their criminal history, they had none, they ended up having these murderers in these, you know, low security, you know.
So it didn't go on the offence.
Yeah, well, it was this funny way of classifying, which we don't do anymore, but... Because murderers do tend to be people who haven't committed offences before or haven't committed that kind of offence before. I mean, if you're committing a murder, you are out of circulation for a long time. So it's unlikely you're going to be a multiple murderer, and you know, because you are obviously in jail for such a long period of your life.
I think we have some common ground.
Yeah.
Like our common ground is we both agree that murderers should not be painted as monsters, that they're not inherently evil. But I think where we diverge is I can't see how it is useful, or I can't see how it's relevant that someone like Rowan Baxter was a star rugby league player. Like, care factor, zero. Well, you know, so, but these are things that get reported in the media, that get talked about in the context of the murder. And I think it detracts from what has happened to these victims and what this person has actually done. Like, I don't think it matters, and it shouldn't matter, that they were good at other things or good otherwise, because now that they have murdered,
they should forever be painted as evil. I think that's a very dangerous approach. I think you need to understand these kind of perpetrators in a whole of person understanding, so that you know.
But who needs to? I think the courts need to. I think that the prison system needs to. I think that corrective services and community supervision needs to, because that is where we can focus on rehabilitation and the issues and all that sort of thing. But for the community, for the media to be saying, oh, but he was such a good bloke, the community don't need to know that.
The departments, with the exception of the courts, you know, the government departments you've talked about, they are influenced by public opinion, because they're ultimately answerable to politicians, and politicians are influenced by public opinion. And I mean, this is in the media, you know, which is where you started. This, you know, violence against women is very much in the media, and this, you know, these cases are very much in the media spotlight. I mean, as they should be, and it's an issue that society should deal with. But I mean, I think that there's no reason it shouldn't be dealt with as rationally and as openly and sensibly and intellectually in the public sphere as it is in the courts. Why should we have a different standard for, oh, well, that's just what lawyers do, you know? But
I can tell you, if someone killed my partner, my husband, or one of my children, and I read an article that says, oh, yeah, he brutally murdered, you know, David, whatever, but oh my gosh, he did great things in his life, I'd be like, get lost. Like, I don't want to read that. I don't want to hear.
Of course, but you're not society. You're the victim.
But why does society need to hear that?
Related to the victim? Well, because society aren't the victim, and aren't related to the victim, and they hopefully can have a more dispassionate, you know, understanding of the problem.
But why should the victim or the victim's families have to be exposed to that because somebody thinks it's relevant to know that at some point in their life they were good people? Yes. All right, tell the courts, yes, we take into account circumstances of the offender when we sentence. Why are the politicians, why are government departments being influenced about whether or not they were a good bloke in their previous life because of what's reported in the media? Sorry, that should have no impact.
I'm not sure that they are, but my point is you say, well, why should we report it in the media like this? Well, the media is the court of public opinion. Public opinion sways politicians. Politicians sway.
And that's my problem.
And sways, well, the reporting that you've obviously pointed out, I think, is pretty lowbrow reporting. I don't think it's particularly helpful.
Okay, so let me see if you think this is any different. So I had a look at some coroner's reports.
Yes.
On these cases that I've flagged.
Yes.
So if we come back to the guy who killed his three children and his wife. So this is an official coroner's report into the deaths of Kim, Fletcher, Mia and Phoebe Hunt in 2015, so not that long ago. The findings of the coroner: I conclude that Jeffrey Hunt shot his wife on a pathway leading from the main entrance of the farmhouse to the carport, and that he then shot each of his children as they lay in bed. When he shot them, he intended to end their lives.
Okay, that seems to be a straight recitation of facts up to that point.
That's the finding.
Yes.
It then went on to say, because it is seeking to explain such a shockingly horrible event, it is unavoidable the focus of the inquest is on indicators of dysfunction, disharmony, and mental illness. But that should not obscure the fact that both Kim and Jeff had done much in their lives to be proud of and had many very admirable qualities. He was successful in his chosen career, perhaps more importantly, was an engaged and caring parent who undoubtedly loved his children. He was the scion of a prominent local grazing family. He was well-liked in the area, charismatic, an excellent sportsman, and a tertiary educated and skillful farmer. He was sociable and hardworking. Okay, how is that? What was the coroner thinking was helpful to list all of these things about the man who killed his three children and his wife?
Okay, well, I don't know what the coroner's thinking, but I'll have a stab at it. You know, I mean, that contextualizes. The passage started with this idea about, you know, mental illness. And if you rule out mental illness, then you've got to then provide some explanation. And if there is nothing in his previous life that would explain it, I think that's worth pointing out. I mean, as opposed to just leaving it.
But can you not point that out by saying he'd suffered because of XYZ? Why? Why is there this list of things that are building him up to be this good person?
I don't know that that's what they're doing. It seems to me they are describing his character prior to him committing this heinous offence as a way to
what?
Put into context what's going on. And if that context may well be absolutely strange, confusing and hard to deal with, because there is nothing in his previous behaviour that indicates that this is what he would do. But that's part of the story. That's what society now has to grapple with. So
he also found, or she, the coroner, also found that the crime was the result of an egocentric delusion that his wife and children would be better off dying than living without him.
Yeah, okay. So why did you make that face? I mean, that sounds, that provides an explanation there.
What on earth does all of that descriptive praise have to do with that egocentric decision?
Well, the answer is I don't know, but it you know, I mean, it wasn't a straight recitation of the facts of his life about what he'd done. There was a you know, a level of descriptive stuff put in there about his life, but I mean, juxtaposing those two things, his otherwise good life, and then this narcissistic sort of incident that causes him to commit this terrible murder. I mean, juxtaposing those two things without any further explanation, I find difficult to do. It's like, well, how did that happen? If he doesn't have a mental illness, you know, what does that mean? You know, did he have a, you know, does that mean
that? Because it was the ultimate control. He didn't want to live anymore. And so he decided to make the decision for his family that they wouldn't want to live without him. This is the epitome of entitlement and masculinity gone wrong. And so the more that we perpetrate this idea that, yes, they're ordinary people, good. Are they good people? No.
Well, up to that point, they were.
But what they were up to that point shouldn't be any kind of focus in the media or for a coroner, for that matter, maybe at sentence, maybe for rehabilitative purposes. But these people we're talking about today all killed themselves after they...
Yeah, but and what is it? What do you take from that? I mean, I take from that, one inference might be, like the farmer you were just talking about, that this is, you know, colossal narcissism. I'm going to kill myself and so I'm going to, no one can live without me, so I'm going to kill them as well. There's colossal narcissism. Terribly toxic trait. I would point out I don't think that males have a, you know, monopoly on narcissism, so I'm not sure that's part of toxic masculinity, but anyway.
Can be part of toxic masculinity but also be present. Perhaps in some females.
Yes. So if we go to Paul Thyssen, he commits suicide. So he alerts the police, he texts the father, he then commits suicide. Now, was there any information about why he did that? Because that might indicate an idea that I am so horrified about what I have done, that I've committed this terrible act, that I can no longer live with myself, so I'm going to kill myself, which is... If that's what he was thinking, I suppose we don't know because he's dead. But if that's what he was thinking, well, that indicates some level of remorse. He is so racked with guilt after what he's done that he then kills himself. So,
well, too little, too late.
Well, maybe, but it's, I mean, like you and I don't. You know, that's up to, you know, God Almighty or Yahweh or Jehovah, whoever it is you worship.
It's like the case of the guy who had wanted to kill himself. To teach his abusive father a lesson. So he'd been abused or mistreated by his dad. And so he asked his dad to go for a walk with him in the bush behind the house. And he took his gun with him because he was going to kill himself in front of his dad to teach his dad a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
But actually when he got out there, he shot his dad instead. Yeah.
Changed his mind.
If you are truly... in that position where you can't see any way out, and suicide to me is one of the saddest things of all. And of course, can I say, I have empathy to a degree for people who cannot see any other way out. Like, I agree with you. These are ordinary people who are making these horrendous, sad, tragic choices. And I do have empathy for that. And well, I don't think I do for Ryan Baxter. But anyway, but that doesn't mean that we can create a narrative where we say, well, they snapped. It was out of character. It was a one-off. Because that one-off, that decision just has ripple effects that spread out. And to try and I see it as trying to minimize.
Yeah, but I agree we can't create that narrative. But if that is the story, then I think it should be told. I mean, and it seems to be, I don't think journalists are making this stuff up. I mean, I think they are reporting what they are being told by the principal or by the, you know, the coroner's reporting. They're not creating a narrative. It is the narrative.
You could find positive things to say about any offender.
Sure.
Well, you go to
actually,
court.
I've met some that you couldn't. Well, not
many.
Yes.
Not many. You go to court and sit in court on a sentencing day.
Yes.
And you will hear for every single offender before that court, things that were positive in their life, things you can point to that were good. And so, okay, that is relevant when assessing the appropriate punishment. But when it's someone who's now dead, who has killed someone and taken their own life, you will always be able to find something good about them, but for what point? Like, what is it serving? Like,
to gain an understanding of why the offender committed the offence.
Knowing
so
he
that
was a prefect at school
can, yes,
does not give you any understanding as to why he chose to kill Hannah.
No, but it does give you understanding.
Oh, sorry, Lily.
Yes, it does give you an understanding of, you know, what kind of a person he was, and you know.
He was a killer.
As it turns out, he was. Nobody knew that in advance. So, you know, and I think that's really the point. All right, Lizzie, there's obviously a lot to talk about in this topic. You've obviously done an enormous amount of work on it. So I think probably what we'll need to do is stop here and continue in the next episode.
Oh, yes, I could talk about this forever. But I'll tell you what, I will talk to you about next time.
Yes.
I did find a South Australian government funded initiative.
Yes.
Which is a list of 7 questions that they suggest men ask themselves to see if they are an indicator of domestic violence. So I want to look at that with you.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. I'm not sure I'm going to say I'm looking forward to discussing with you, but certainly it will be an interesting discussion.
I think so.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.